Good morning. I call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Please silence all cell phones. The time is 9:05 a.m. April 14th. I'm joined by Co-Chair Stedman, Co-Chair Olson, Co-Chair Hoffman is dealing with some volcanic ash, Senator Wilson, Senator Merrick, and Senator Keel. Today's agenda, there are two items on today's agenda. First up is SB 41 capital budget. We're going to adopt a CS and set the bill aside. And the second action item for the morning will be the presentation by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We're going to talk about the earnings reserve account, portfolio gains, realized and unrealized gains and losses. And that'll take a brief at ease at that point and switch out chairman. So Senator Stedman will carry that side of the portfolio. So Senate Bill 41 capital budget. Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that the Senate Finance Committee adopt the committee substitute for Senate Bill 41, version S, as in Skagway, as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for purposes of discussion. Mr. Grusendorf, will you please come before the committee and put yourself on the record and explain the changes?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Tim Grusendorf, staff to the Senate Finance Committee. I want to thank the chairman for filling in for the senator from Bethel. It's important to keep this bill on schedule, working towards a smooth and orderly adjournment in May. In front of the committee is CSS for SB 41 / S, the FY 24 capital budget, and the FY 23 supplemental budget. We are going to refer to this bill right from here on forward right now as CS1. Mr. Chairman, CS1 has the same parameters as the CS1 you brought before this committee last year. The only difference is you haven't aged a bit, and at this end of the table, there's like three decades of aging. CS1 is a bare-bones capital budget with all discretionary GF and reapproach removed and sets the base budget of federal funds, matching general funds, and other funds only. Familiar items that fall into these categories include village safe water, drinking water, AHFC programs, airport improvement program, and the DOT transportation program, to name the bulk of the items that are still in the budget. On page 27, CS1 of the FY24 capital budget shows the totals of this base budget. This budget has $177,881,470 of unrestricted general funds, $55,307,304 designated general funds, $47,612,900 of non-duplicated funds, $99,876,424 duplicated funds, and $2,094,528,059 in federal funds. The totals for the supplemental capital budget on page 33 of the bill shows the $1,362,698 of general fund match, $35,604,490 of other non-duplicated funds, and $44,589,529 in federal receipts. I talked about earlier, there isn't any reappropriations in the 24 capital budget on the first part of it. But in the supplemental, we do have a handful of reapproaches, and those are included this year because as bills were being put together at the end of last session, Those capital projects were only given a one-year time period, where most of them get five. So the reapproach that you'll see on those last on page 34 and 35 are those reapproaches and giving them the full five-year time period for those projects.
Senator Olson,
Mr. Grusendorf, do you have a copy of those reapproaches? Is the copy of the reapproaches in the packet we have?
Yes. Yeah, they're on page 34 and 35 of the of those projects that were only given a one-year.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
All right. Senator Stedman.
We're having questions, Mr. Chairman. I was just curious. My understanding from the
presentation is the match monies in for federal highways and airports.
Correct.
And, Mr. Chairman, does that include the Marine Highway match for the grants?
Yes, and it also includes money for the rural ferry grants.
All right, if I'm going to remove my objection, and then we can go to more committee questions, if that's all right with the committee. At this time, I'll remove my objection to version S, and it's now before us as our working document. Any other committee questions before we set the bill aside for further review? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The last couple of years, we've been, particularly last year, we concentrated here at the table on major maintenance, deferred maintenance across the university and the state as a focal point. And we do have major maintenance list run for the committee every year. And I'm just wondering what the thoughts are on dealing with major maintenance, deferred maintenance in particular, in the current CS, and what are some of the thoughts going forward possibly?
Thank you. Through the chair, Senator Stedman. As far as deferred maintenance, I think this committee needs to make those decisions. If it wasn't designated or money that just general funds that could be used, discretionary funds, then the deferred maintenance stuff will be in there. It's the stuff that anything above and beyond what is match, that'll be up to this committee to decide going forward.
All right, seeing no further questions, Mr. Drusendorf, thank you. I'm going to set this bill aside. We're going to take a brief at ease and switch out chairs. Brief at ease.
Finance Committee to come back to order. Apologize for the brief delay. We just had to swap some seats around as we're one member down today. The next presentation, long awaited for 2 weeks anyway, from the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. We're going to have a discussion on the current status of the Permanent Fund, kind of the review of their earnings capacities and capabilities, kind of what they think is coming forward, to help guide the Finance Committee in their decisions as we look forward to trying to put together the best budget for the state that we can, including dealing with the previous issue at the table, the capital budget, along with dividends for the citizens running our schools and keeping our state operating. So with that, Mr. Mitchell, come on forward. Mr. Frampton, you might as well join him. I know he's going to throw you a lifeline, which is fine because of the subject matter and the depth of the information delivered here today. So with that, I'd like to turn it over to Mr. Mitchell to briefly introduce himself for the record and take us through his presentation, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Devin Mitchell, Executive Director of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And as you alluded, there are two components to today's presentation. The first section is more 30,000 foot level, although with some detail, and then our Chief Investment Officer, Marcus Frampton, will do more of a drill down on the asset classes and how the fund's investments work for the committee's edification. And so these are familiar slides to the committee. We've showed these before. Obviously, the folks are generally aware, and we'll just breeze through some of these, but the permanent fund was created by a constitutional amendment in 1976. The Constitution requires that 25% of certain revenues, primarily royalty revenue, be deposited, thank you, into the permanent fund. And I think one of the key components of today's presentation is the intergenerational nature of the permanent fund, and that historically every generation of Alaskans since 1977 has given something up in their current year ability to spend money so that the permanent fund would exist and provide for us today as well as those that come in the future. One of the complexities of the permanent fund as it currently exists is the two-account system, and that's one of the primary drivers of today's conversation, is the way that money becomes available to expend within the permanent fund umbrella. And so you have the principal, which is only $52 billion of the approximately $76 billion that's in the fund today. And the portion that's available for expenditure is part of the additional $24 billion that either resides in the principal and unrealized gains or in the earnings reserve as available or unrealized gains. And how money becomes available to spend for transfer to the state to spend is generally when we actually receive dollars in our hand. And so realized gains, and it's defined in statute, we refer to it as statutory net income. It is a constrainer when you have gains, for example, in real estate. It's just like if you own a home that you bought for $100,000 and now it's worth $200,000, you have $100,000 of unrealized gains. You can't spend that money. You have to actually sell your house to get that extra $100,000 that then you would be able to spend. And it's a similar experience within the fund, that we have certain asset classes that Marcus will explain in a few moments that are less liquid, that have unrealized gains that don't lend themselves to statutory net income in the short term. They will in the long term, but it's in the current environment, it has become a concern of the corporation, not from our statutory mandate, because we're not obligated under our statutes to ensure that we provide the percent of market value transfer to the state, but as a good state citizen, if you will, that we want to be good partners with the legislature and executive branch and ensure that we do meet the needs of the state as expected now and into the future. So this next slide, again, you've seen before, it shows that principal component of $52.1 billion, the unrealized gains associated with that, which are pro rata allocated, the unrealized gains. And so they are fluid. They aren't hardwired into either one of these accounts. So, for example, as the FY23 inflation proofing gets transferred to principal, you'll have a correlated $700 or $800 million that flows from that $2.2 billion of unrealized gains currently associated with the earnings reserve account going up to the principal box. And the same thing as money is spent on the FY2024 percent of market value transfer, the $3.5 billion, you'll have an additional amount that would flow up to the unrealized gains because pro rata, the ERA would become smaller. This realized earnings that's available at this point. So we have money committed in the current fiscal year, and we have money that's going to be committed in the coming fiscal year. So this is really, as of July 1, you would have realized earnings left that was available for expenditure in a hard fashion, meaning that it's in the account right now of $4 billion. If there are additional earnings that flow into the earnings reserve from realized income over the remaining fiscal year, balance will have something around $4.6 billion in the earnings reserve account on that July 1st date. If you subtract FY25 percent of market value, the projected POMV, which is pretty close to what it's going to be, it's $3.66 billion. So you're left with about $1 billion of available at the beginning of the fiscal year. You'll have earnings throughout the course of the fiscal year, statutory net income throughout the course of FY2024, but that money would in part be potentially obligated for inflation proofing for FY2024, and then you know that you're going to have a 2026 draw on, again, a POMV draw that's going to be coming up. And so if you have a remaining balance of $1 billion and you add in something close to what we're getting in the current year of $2 billion in statutory net income, you can quickly see that there's a cause for paying attention to what's going on. Inflation proofing is one of the core tenets of the program, and it's inflation proofing just the principal. And so when you think about the permanent fund, again, I said the current balance is around $76 billion. The $76 billion doesn't get inflation proof, just the $52 billion. So about three quarters of the amount is actually what's being inflation proof. So it could be a higher standard if it were inflation proofing the entire balance of the fund. But the you can see the prior transfers for inflation proofing, 16 through 18 and 21 and 22, where there wasn't specific inflation proofing transfers, were obviously made up for in part by the 2020 and 2022 special appropriations, in no small part because of the work of this committee. And it's, again, that intergenerational aspect of the fund, and that if you don't inflation proof, if you don't set money aside in principle, the ability to buy whatever your favorite thing is, a stick of gum, an apple, a can of beer, whatever your favorite thing is, it's going to be diminished in the future if you don't inflation proof your principal to ensure that you're going to have the same buying power in the future that you have today. If folks were interested in how the inflation proofing is calculated, it's the monthly index value CPI averaged over the prior two, each of the prior two calendar years, and the difference is the formulaic outcome for determining the percentage for inflation proofing the fund, so 8% from 21 to 22, a high inflation year, which definitely exacerbates the issue that I described on the prior side when you have high inflation. On page 6, this is just a historical summary of the earnings reserve account. The red line is the trend in the earnings reserve account in isolation, and you can see that we had a net add to the fund from 14 through 18. In 19, we had the percent of market value transfer implemented, and we had a net $400 million diminishment of the earnings reserve account. That's after inflation proofing. That increased to $4.6 billion in 2020. There was a increase in fund in the earnings reserve account balance in 2021 with that high earnings year of almost $8 billion. And then again in 2022, a reduction of about $2.5 billion. So over that last 4 years, you saw about a $2.8 billion reduction in the earnings reserve account balance as a result of the activity that occurred during those years. And again, it's in no small part because the fund now is relied upon through the percent of market value for more than just paying permanent fund dividends. It's in fact also paying for roads, schools, you name whatever the state pays for. This slide just graphically shows the experience that we're having with statutory net income in the current year relative to the last few years. You can see that FY 2023 is a low statutory net income year through February, just over $1 billion. If you looked at the projections from Callan, they had something along the line of $5 billion in statutory net income. And so from an average recent historical perspective, that's not necessarily that far out of line, but from a longer term historical perspective, it is. And so it's, I think I used the term earlier that sometimes Callan is a little, they're a little slow to adjust course. And as a result, we wind up with some projections that we need to take with a grain of salt. And so for this year, we just adjusted our assumption for the fiscal year downward from the original Callan's assumption to the experience through February and then Callan's assumption for the remainder of the fiscal year. I think that still generates an expectation of higher statutory net income than we actually expect to receive at this time. And again, Marcus will drill down into that a little bit more in a few slides.
So that's going to come in more detail in the future?
Okay. Yes.
We'll wait till then.
And then these last couple of slides are really just the altruistic goals of the board as well as staff that if there were a way to ensure that we had the most durable permanent fund possible, it would be to constitutionalize the annual draw, the percent of market value draw on the fund, so then you wouldn't have to worry about inflation proofing, you wouldn't have to worry about the potential of overdrawing current year earnings at the expense of future generations, because it would just be a one account that spends out money to the state annually without a lot of the noise that we have in that current structure. And this is just a graphical depiction of what that might look like on page 9, where you have, instead of two accounts, just one account, and a very significant simplification of the process from both our perspective as well as, I think, our constituents' perspective. And with that, I'll hand it over to Marcus to get into that detail.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Marcus Frampton. I'm the Chief Investment Officer of APFC. Oh, okay. So I just thought I'd start with a few summary concepts on how we manage the fund and how that flows through to statutory net income, and also some factors on where we are today. So today we've got just under $12 billion of unrealized gains in the portfolio. Close to 90% of those are in our illiquid asset classes. A little more than 10% are in stocks and bonds, and I'll break that down on a subsequent page, but that does have implications for the lumpiness of how gains flow through to statutory net income. Another factor, and I'll quantify this later, is private equity has been a big driver of gains the last few years. And the driver of those gains is exit activity from external managers. So we're a limited partner in venture capital funds and buyout funds. When they exit investments by taking them public or selling them, we get distributions. And if they're doing a good job, those distributions are half or two-thirds gains, half or one-third cost basis. So those private distributions are down 50% year over year. If we just look at the first three quarters of this fiscal year versus last, that's a direct outgrowth of where markets are and outside of our control because they're third-party managers. The good news is there's a baseline statutory net income, and that number is the interest we receive from our bonds, our dividends on our stock portfolio, and rental income on our real estate portfolio. That number is about $1.6 billion a year, and as you forecast the number, you can kind of just take that to the bank unless we go into some kind of just extreme depression where companies aren't making interest payments on debt. So that's the baseline number. I wanted to Callan forecast about $5 billion a year of statutory net income. That is a totally reasonable forecast if one assumes that stocks return 7% a year, which is their forecast for stocks over the next 10 years. And then the issue is just year-to-year variability and like what happens if you're in a zero return world. So if the Fed just pivots tomorrow and the party starts again in the stock market, we'll be back to kind of a $5 billion run rate because the market's going up and we're rebalancing the portfolio and trading in and out of positions. I wanted to highlight the last point is we observe these things and we notice the relationships among them, but we don't manage to statutory net income in the management of the portfolio. I've been at the fund for 10 years. We've never made a decision based off of, hey, let's realize a gain over here. It's all how do we manage the best risk return against our benchmarks? And then an outgrowth of that is that we're turning the portfolio over and realizing gains. So this is the detail by asset class on where the gains sit today. So in our stock portfolio, we have $2.6 billion of gains. Our stock portfolio, we probably turn over somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 to 35% a year. So if you just anticipated a 0% of flat stock market, my best guess is that we generate $700 or $800 million of gains out of our stock portfolio in the next 12 months. Fixed income, we have about $1 billion loss in that area, unrealized loss, as a result of interest rates going up and our existing bonds being worth less as a result. That portfolio, we turn over more, so maybe 70-80% turnover in a year. So again, flat markets, I would, in the next 12 months, anticipate our stock gains to about offset our bond losses. Our absolute return portfolio, those are hedge fund managers. So we're a limited partner in a partnership that goes and trades in markets. And we've built up over $1 billion gain there. Those don't really get harvested unless we terminate a manager. So the underlying manager is realizing gains and losses, but our instrument is an LP investment in a partnership. And we don't turn that over much at all. So we have one manager in particular that we've had money with for over a decade that's several hundred million of that billion too. Private equity and private income is the line that I was referring to on the prior page where distributions are down 50% year over year. So right there, those two lines is over half of our unrealized gains. We're limited partners and partnerships managed by third parties that buy companies and sell companies, and we get our gains when they sell the companies, and they're doing less of that today. Real estate, we tend to own properties directly for the long term. So our biggest single gain in that portfolio is the Tysons Corner Mall in Washington, D.C., we made that investment in the 1980s at well under $100 million cost basis, and it's appraised at over $700 million today. So that's just that one unrealized gain is a big part of that real estate gain. We're going to go through the history of statutory net income on a subsequent page, and you'll see in, I believe it's 2017, it might have been 2018, there's a real big year that we sold a multi-billion-dollar apartment portfolio that year. So sometimes looking at all the factors, we'll say, hey, we want to exit this investment and you'll generate a big gain, but it's not what I would call recurring, whereas the real estate rental income is part of that baseline $1.6 billion where we can count on that every year. So I'll just pause there, see if there are questions, but that's the snapshot of where we are today on statutory net income and unrealized gains.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you comment on the fixed income that's got a negative $1 billion in it?
Sure. So thank you, Senator Olson. Our fixed income portfolio has a duration of around 6 or 7 years. And so when rates go up, like they have in the last year with the Fed's trying to fight inflation, so they're raising interest rates, the existing bonds we own that had a lower interest rate are worth less to the tune of $1 billion. And so that's driven entirely by interest rates, and we turn the portfolio over a lot, so that should get realized probably in the next 12 months.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, go ahead.
So the plan is to go ahead and wait it out in the market until the inflation rates start to decrease and interest in the burning or the earning, the borrowing capability is put down, so the value goes back up.
I wouldn't say our strategy is to wait it out. We're our fixed income team is managing that portfolio against a benchmark, mm-hmm. and they're actively trading every day. They're one of their big strategies is to get better pricing on new issue bonds. So if a company issues a bond, they give price concession. One of our strategies is we like to take that price concession, so we'll get a cheap bond and we'll sell an old bond. And so we're turning that portfolio over probably 80% a year. So I wouldn't say that we're waiting it out. We're just kind of doing our normal trading activity.
One last question, Mr. Chairman. Yes. As you look at history and you see, we see the, many of us remember the Lehman Brothers going down actually. And as we look at more recently Silicon Valley having a problem, as well as the bank up in New York, how has that changed your investment strategy since you're the chief investment person?
Thank you, Senator Olson. I would say that we're very cautious right now. There's many market indicators that would suggest that there's a good chance we're headed to a recession, and it could be a bad recession. Mm-hmm. So that manifests itself in a pretty material underweight to our stocks. So we're 2% underweight stocks right now. And then we've, going back 2 or 3 years, we've really cut back our commitment pace to private equity and private income. So I think we're going into whatever we're going into from a position of being cautiously positioned, extra liquidity versus what we would otherwise have. But we're pretty cautious and pessimistic right now, I would say.
Last question, Mr. Chairman, on this particular item. As you look at the Fed, and there are the people that are kind of in the driver's seat as to what's going on, if there's a change in the Fed chairman, do you think that's will change the idea that we're going to go into a recession, or do you have an opinion on that at all?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Senator Olson. Chair Powell has been very aggressive in raising rates, and he's been very aggressive in his rhetoric that his priority is to get inflation under control, and the market hasn't always listened. You know, the market will rally, and then he'll remind them of his policy, and it'll come down. I think he's as focused on a tight monetary position as any of his peers. So if he were replaced, I would anticipate he'd be replaced by someone who's more inclined to have easier money. And so that would result in a lower probability of a recession, but a higher probability of high inflation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. No further questions.
So on slide 12, you were mentioning a lot of the illiquidity within these asset classes, but could you give us a rough total of the illiquidity portion of this $11
million? Yes. It's about 85% illiquid, 15% stocks and bonds.
85, 15?
Roughly, yes.
Okay. So I'm not a mathematician, but that's a little over $1.7 billion or $1.8 billion in liquidity, somewhere in there.
Correct.
Doesn't that seem to be a little tight on the liquidity portion?
Mr. Chair, this is Devin Mitchell again. I think Marcus described earlier that we don't manage the portfolio for liquidity. We manage for maximum return and keeping principal safe. And that said, it's a function of the market that we're in that liquidity has decreased, as CIO Frampton described earlier, that private equity exits have slowed as a result of current market experience. And that, I don't believe, was necessarily anticipated by anybody. If you looked back a year or 2 years, and you certainly wouldn't have wanted to have not had that private equity exposure during those time frames, because it was the best performing asset class that we have. And so it's a matter of balancing a variety of needs. And one other point, just on the fixed income side, it's not that we have. You're entirely right, Senator Olson, that if we just held those positions to maturity, we would get whatever the stated coupon or the yield that we bought those securities at. It's a function, and we'll get that even through active management of the portfolio. It just means that we're going to get more money in the future than we would today based on our buying higher interest rates. Yeah.
I think I should have couched the question in that. With different benchmarks on it, because what I was trying to ask is we've got the unrealized gains. We understand no one here controls the markets. We're along for the ride, good or bad, up or down. But we need to keep an eye on the earnings reserve position and the liquidity, you know, of that in case there is a call from the legislature to the permanent fund for, you know, some assistance to pay our bills, which is the 5% draw, and God forbid an overdraw. So that was really the point of the question, is with the current trends over the last year or so pushing us into a more illiquid earnings reserve. That was, so I guess I didn't couch the question correctly, because I interpreted the answer was more of an explanation of why we're here and why that wasn't the point I was trying to get on the table. Mr. Marcus, I think you're going to go into that in more detail.
Sure. And thank you, Chair Stedman. I wanted to highlight it. The fund has substantial liquidity and our investments in the earnings reserve. I think we were highlighting that the location of the unrealized gains is largely in private, but I mean the fund at close to $80 billion is over half in assets that we could liquidate in 2 days if we needed to. So like we have substantial liquidity. It's just the gains
stop
of the
port. Just stop for a minute. We're not going to go in and spend the principal. Okay. We're not even going to contemplate that, or even an overdraw of 5%. So what we're really trying to do is get the information on the constraints that the legislature faces, particularly the Finance Committee faces dealing with the earnings reserve account. Yeah, that's the focus. So we want to try to keep it narrowed into that, because we don't want to have people get a misimpression that we're going to go hog wild in liquidity and have a hell of a party here. It's not going to happen.
Mr. Chair, I think that's thank you for the clarification. And we're talking by each other a little bit, because there are two different things that we're discussing, and the statutory net income isn't liquidity as Marcus is thinking about it, because, yeah, we have 36% or along that line invested in public equities that we could liquidate at a moment's notice, like Marcus said. So from a cash flow perspective, it's really that definition of statutory net income, and it again ties back into the complexity of the two-account system that we find ourselves with at this point, relative to if we just had a one-account system. These unrealized gains can churn out over the life of the permanent fund, and we're relatively indifferent in that scenario, whether the unrealized gains are in 20 years or this year, where what we're talking about is the difficulty of the constraint of only being able to expend certain classes of income in the current construct.
Okay.
So just continuing along, I think this is largely a repeat. It's just a summary of our ability to access or the drivers of realized gains by asset class, and notably that real estate is irregular property distributions, private equity and private income is third-party manager exit activity. So that's a majority of the unrealized gains are in those areas that are not regular or in our control necessarily. From a historical...
You have a question, Senator Bishop?
Yes, I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Frampton, back to page 13. Where would the gold exchange ETFs be warehoused in?
Thank you, Senator Bishop. We have gold holdings in our cash account. I didn't include cash here because it's our smallest asset class. And then we also own gold in our absolute return investment area. So that is roughly 5% of our absolute return portfolio. So to be entirely accurate, absolute return is 95% redemptions for managers, 5% we could trade out of the gold on 2 days' notice.
Thank you.
Okay, next slide.
So I wanted to share a historical snapshot of the statutory net income that the fund has generated. The blue line is what the investment return for the year on the fund was. So you see some correlation between investment returns and the statutory net income. It's not a perfect correlation because we have to items hit our return immediately and then flow to statutory net income on a delayed basis. But in fiscal 2009, there was negative statutory net income. So that year, the losses we realized through trading exceeded the dividends, interest, and rental income. And then last year in fiscal 22, we lost about 1% was the fund's return, but we still had a statutory net income of over $4 billion. We've noted that the Callan forecast for statutory net income is $5 billion a year, which corresponds to a 7% stock market return. We've only exceeded $5 billion twice in our history. In 2018, we had two very large private exits. One was a real estate portfolio that generated close to $600 million of gains. Then we also took a portfolio of LP interests and private equity funds to the market and sold for several hundred million gain that year. That was an opportunistic exit. Today, that market's really dried up, so you'd get maybe 80 cents on the dollar if you try to do something like that today, whereas in 2018, you can do that around the holding value. And then in fiscal 21, there was a really large statutory net income year. That was just equity rebalancing. The market was exuberant, and every time we went over our target to equities, we'd trim and we'd generate gains by rebalancing that frequently. I think that it's just helpful to know that we do, at least in one case, we've had a negative statutory net income year. And then as the fund grows, we've gotten to the point where we can generate $5 billion a year, but it's pretty lumpy in terms of that level.
I know before you go on, I know you guys in the permanent fund, your job isn't to deal with the dividend per se, just to manage the fund. But my understanding is a statutory net income when you have big years like in 2021 and 2022, because 18's dropped off, leads to increased calculation on the statutory dividend. Is that correct?
Through the chair, yes.
So this is the driver of the statutory dividend?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. The statutory dividend is based on 5 years of historical earnings, a percentage of 21% of the last 5 years' earnings, half of that.
Yeah, five-year look back,
yep.
The average of that, and half of that then goes to the statutory dividend. So then am I to conclude that the likelihood of the statutory dividend calculation on the average is has a higher probability of coming down than going up?
Mr. Chair, the current fiscal year's anticipated statutory net income is $2 billion plus or minus $400 million, probably more on the plus than the minus side, but still a relatively muted statutory net income year. If that trend were to continue, then that would very quickly drive down the formulaic calculation for the statutory dividend.
So the statutory net income estimate for the end of FY23, what number should we, if we were to estimate that, should we use 2.5, 1.5, 3.5? Can you give us any assistance on that? We're not going to hold you to the dollar because we don't expect you to fully anticipate between now and the end of the fiscal year.
And Marcus could add to this answer perhaps, but just the assumption that we have on our projection sheet at this point, which is, as I said earlier, the experience through, I believe, February, and then Callan's assumption for the balance of the year generated a mid expectation of $2,876 million in statutory net income, a low scenario of $2,475 million, and a high scenario of $3,353 million. I think we're trending towards the low scenario or lower at this point. And so if in my conversations with Mr. Frampton, we don't have any of the lumpy exits that he described in 2018 or the exuberance that we saw in 21 expected to result in significant realized gains in certain asset classes that otherwise wouldn't generate those types of gains. And so if it were just me, I would be using the low case scenario at this point in time and still being a little skeptical.
Okay.
So this is just further detail. I just wanted to highlight the history of gains in the fund. And even though we're being somewhat pessimistic in terms of our ability to forecast the gains realization, the number is high today from a historical standpoint, at close to $12 billion. But the number, the bottom line, there's a dollar amount that's in the public market portfolio that turns over a lot, and that's a fairly low number at $1.6 billion. When we finished 21, that was $8 billion. Throughout time, it's probably been more like 50% typically, and today it's 86. So I just wanted to give that context. And then this is more detail that we've spoken to already on where these gains came from. You see in 21, that kind of monster year for equities, where we were rebalancing all year, drove that number. And then you see, that's the dark blue for 21 was public equities. Private equity is the orange bar on top of the dark blue. So that big year in 21 was public equity, private equity. Then 2018, you see that light blue is that real estate exit. And then you don't see much light blue after that. That was kind of the last time we had a big exit in real estate. So just more context on the asset class level where these realizations are coming from.
Okay, if you can stop there for a minute, maybe back up 16, please. So help me understand the concept. We've got an expectation of a 7% return by Callan and an expectation using that 7% return of $5 billion in gains a year, portfolio profits a year. But when I look on the chart here, you mentioned that FY21 is an anomaly because we had a strong bull market forcing you to rebalance. We had real estate sales for decades of holding some big real estate. And we also had a pretty significant year in 22. I can't remember quite offhand on 18, goes back a ways, but it just seems $5 billion is way above any trend here, or even $3 billion looks pretty rosy once you take out FY21 and FY18. So help me with that, putting that puzzle together.
Yeah, through the chair, Chair Stedman, I should highlight this excludes the baseline dividends, interest, and rental income. So this is realized capital gains. So statutory net income for each of these years is this number plus roughly $1.6 billion. And that's a big part of the difference, I think.
Okay. That helps a lot. That closes the gap.
So this is a concept that I wanted to share, and I believe that Mr. Painter at Legislative Finance has a similar concept when he's modeling statutory net income. And basically what we're – this is a very high-level, somewhat imprecise concept because it's blending across asset classes. And what we're doing is looking at what gains in every year were available through through return from that year and through unrealized gains coming into that year, and then what were our realized gains? So excluding the baseline dividends interest, the realized capital gains as a percentage of unrealized gains available that year, and how's that trended over time? We're calling it turnover rate, but I kind of wish I called it something else, because to me, turnover rate is how much you turn the portfolio over in a year, and this is how much are you realizing unrealized gains. They're slightly different concepts. And, you know, the 69% in 09 is a little misleading because we had such low unrealized gains at that point that, you know, you sell a building here, you sell a stock there, and it gets generated. We had a lot of investments around cost basis then, so if you turn those over, it doesn't – we're just focusing on what are the unrealized gains and what's the statutory net income. So it got really high at that period when we had very low levels of unrealized gains. But then after that, it has averaged kind of between 20 to mid-30s of our unrealized gains. I believe Mr. Painter used a 20% figure. And so when you look at this chart, you kind of see why he would do that. And I think that a metric like this roughly corresponds to the numbers that Mr. Mitchell just mentioned on, you know, maybe – I forget the exact number you said, but kind of maybe in the – $2.5 billion range for this year. So, like, we are still generating exits on private equity. They're just down half from the year before. We are, every time you turn on CNBC and you see the market's up 2% that day, you can guarantee we're selling stocks down the street. So we're generating gains at different levels. And, you know, if you look at that 20% figure at the 12 months forward with $12 billion of unrealized gains, that would imply that in the next 12 months we'll maybe generate a couple billion of realized gains from the unrealized levels, and then you add the interest, dividends, and rental income to that, and maybe you get to a number a little over $3 billion in a flat environment. Now, you go to an environment where the market's going up 7% a year, that's when you go from 3 to 5. Where you're really doing more rebalancing of equities and you're adding to that, I'll just for rough justice say, $2.5-3 billion of statutory net income in a flat market per year is how I would, if I was like really roughly trying to give an estimate. And I think that corresponds to some of the modeling Mr. Painter did, but I wanted to at least make an attempt of explaining this turnover number because I think it's used in some other analysis that gets presented to you guys. This page is kind of repeat information. I'm just showing how distributions from private equity and private income have evolved over time. And when I say they're down 50%, I'm comparing Q1 to Q3 fiscal 23 to Q1 to Q3 fiscal 22. So they're not – they haven't completely turned off, but they're down substantially, and then you see like the enormous, the $5 billion exit figure in 2022, that really helped drive, along with the public equities, the big year for statutory net income we had that year. This page shows over time the baseline statutory net income number, the number that we add realized capital gains to get statutory net income. The orange line is this number as a percent of total fund. And as we've had less in the bond portfolio, you know, our interest element of this equation's gone down a little bit. But the fund's grown offsetting that. So the baseline cash flow that we get is around $1.6 billion a year and is fairly recurring in nature.
So if we can stop there before we go on. So this is the data set you're using when you come up with your baseline net income?
Through the chair, yes, that's correct.
Okay, and then, again, this is back of the envelope here. But when I look back on slide 16, where we've got our realized gains historically, and you know, knocking out those big years, 21 and 18, and looks like we're somewhere between 2 and 3 billion, somewhere in there, a little less than 3. But when you add those together, if it's, you know, ends up 3.6 or 4.6 billion a year when we take our average realized gains and our and then our the net income base, and we try to guess what our dividend's going to be going forward. It looks like if we have to average about 4 billion a year to equal the 50-50 dividend that's on the table today, the dividend of 2.7, 2.8 billion, it takes about 4 billion a year just to produce that 50-50 dividend. And what I'm interpreting telling us, there is reasonable uncertainty that that's not going to occur. It may be, let me rephrase that. Four billion is a target that is halfway between that range when you add the realized gains plus the income of 3.6 to 4.6. So our statutory net income could look going forward can very well equal the 50-50 dividend with a very tight margin. And I think I'll ask Mr. Painter to calculate that, because I see you guys looking at the end of the table trying to calculate that in your head, but I will admit I cheated and have it on a spreadsheet in front of me so I know what the number is. But what I did know was the number of that you guys were going to give us on realized gains and then the baseline statutory income. That was the unknown. And it is $4 billion, pretty close, that we have to have materialized to match that statutory dividend, the 50-50 dividend of this year, $2.8 billion. But we'll have Mr. Painter calculate that from Ledge Finance, and we'll look at that with some sensitivity analysis on it, because I know you guys aren't in the realm of the dividend. Senator Bishop.
I pass. I'll wait till you.
Mr. Chair, this is Devin Mitchell again. Just to your point, I think over the long term, you might have some reversion to the mean, but if you look back at the presentation we gave the last time we were before committee, there was a chart that showed 10-year historical return expectations and whether or not we hit our target of 5% plus inflation. And there, if you recall, are cycles that reflect very clearly in that chart. So we in the first 5 or 6 years of the 10-year look backs, the fund exceeded the target. And then for the next 8 or 9 year, 10-year look backs, it didn't. And then the most recent 4 or 5 10-year look backs, it again did. And so what you're describing is, I think, likely to play out in scenarios where you're going to get less with a historical look back for perhaps decades in one scenario versus another. And so when you're having Alexi look at that, I would suggest that you look at some of that historical data to provide for his analysis.
We can ask him to do that, because it's not a clear crystal ball. It's pretty foggy, but if we can just get the range and the magnitude right, or the direction and the magnitude, it makes it, we have a higher likelihood of making good policy calls. Senator Bishop?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You know, I'm not to go back in the slide deck, but you had the one slide on the putting a POMV in the Constitution. So since we've changed the statute to start using the 5% POMV draw, have you changed your investment strategies?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, no.
And so conversely, if it was collapsed into the Constitution, your strategies wouldn't change either?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, under the current construct, no. The asset allocation can change from year to year. There is an update of that annually, so there can be changes, but they're not driven by those factors.
Last question, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. Hypothetically, if it was collapsed into the corpus, would you might manage more for long-term cash returns or not?
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, the simple answer is we don't manage for cash returns right now.
Not cash returns, but more value to the fund. Let me put it that way.
I think it would make, and again, I would defer to Marcus on this, but I think it would make the long-term view a little easier for the fund to advocate for, because it is I think folks are cognizant of the needs of the state as it relates to the permanent fund for annual revenue at this point in time, and whether or not that's just in the background or not, it does have it does become part of the discussion. And so if there were an elimination of some of the concerns swirling around liquidity and the statutory net income means of providing revenue into the earnings reserve that then is available for further for appropriation, it would simplify some of that thought process.
Thank you.
Any other questions on slide 19?
So this is just the final slide and some conclusions or highlights. I wanted everyone to be aware of the baseline statutory net income that is fairly reliable at roughly $1.5 billion, $1.6 billion. The realized portion is less reliable, as we've covered, and subject to market vagaries and third-party exit decisions. I did want to point out that I think when we're going through the numbers, it's easy to think about a flat stock market as a way to frame what the go-forward statutory net income might be, and Devin made an estimate earlier. There is also a scenario where stock markets go down further. It's still a fairly expensive market right now, with the potential of a recession and things like that. And we do have it 1 year in our history of negative statutory net income. There is a downside case where equities go down further, and then you're realizing that $2.6 billion of unrealized gains in equities could swing to no gains or swing to unrealized losses. And then as we turn the portfolio over, it could be generating losses. So that's like the real downside case, is further equity declines. And then as discussed, 86% of the unrealized gains today sit in illiquid asset classes. So those are, I think, the four considerations I would leave you guys with.
Okay. And before you get away, we have you come back sometime in the future and see how clear the crystal ball was. We should talk a little bit while we got you here about inflation proofing. The committee has been very concerned and interested in seeing that the permanent fund's been inflation proofed, and we've got also toy checks on the wall where we've actually advocated and put in funds into the corpus to protect them from spending. This year, it looks like we might have some challenges dealing with inflation proofing, and that inflation proofing number expectation or assumption is, can you remind the public what that is for this year's budget cycle, if you happen to know?
For
slide five.
Mr. Chair, for FY 2020, 23, it's 4.2 billion.
Right. And that'll be on slide five for those watching. I want to go back to the slide. We'll have that discussion here with the committee members on what we want to do. I think it's probably relatively likely that we won't include it in the budget because of the concern with the earnings reserve, and we want to make sure everything runs smooth. But we have a deep concern that we keep it inflation-proof. I think we have the opportunity a year from now, or a little less than that, when we do a potential fast-track supplemental next February or March, that we could pick it up and include it, because I think that doesn't the transfer actually take place in about a year and a quarter from now?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay. So we have the window. If we decide to not include it in this budget cycle, to review the liquidity position in February or March, and add the FY24 inflation proofing in, and I just would like you to relay that to the board. That if it's not in, because I know it's a concern of the board, permanent fund board, that the permanent fund be inflation proofed. It's equally concerning here. But we've got other cash demands that we have to also keep an eye on in balance. So I just don't want them to conclude that if we do not include it in the budget, which is reasonably likely, that it is a foregone conclusion that we're not going to do it, because that's not the case. Do we have any comments or input? Senator Merrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Faz, for being here today. Do you see any downside to constitutionalizing the POMB and combining the ERA and corpus?
Through the chair, Senator Merrick, I personally see upside. It takes away all of the noise surrounding the fund. It eliminates the conversation about inflation proofing as you were speaking, I was thinking, well, wouldn't it be nice if we could even just appropriate unrealized gains to principal, but in our construct, we can't. It has to come out of the earnings reserve account portion in that portion, which is available otherwise for the other needs of the state. Because the cons, like I said earlier, about three quarters of the permanent fund, or two thirds is protected, and a quarter or a third is in the other bucket, even though it's not in the ERA. It not only solves that issue, it also solves the issue of concern about the potential of not abiding by the intergenerational contract that is before this body right now and every year right now.
Thank you.
The other thing I forgot to mention in talking about the inflation proofing, we can also do partial. You know, we've got the flexibility to do $1 billion or $2 billion or some other number. So we'll look at that as we try to decide what we want to have in the budget when it leaves the table. But my main concern here is I don't want the permanent fund board to think that we're taking a directional difference from history. Because it is hard to catch up on inflation proofing when you have numbers like $4 billion.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I would echo your comments that this is inflation proofing is a top priority of the board, and to the extent you can have some form of intent language, to the extent there wasn't an inflation proofing appropriation for FY24, to the extent you could have intent language to have it revisited with the supplemental, or have some smaller amount of inflation proofing, even if it wasn't the full statutory inflation proofing, that I think those would be positive steps that we'd be appreciative of.
And we'll get with you guys on how that looks management wise for the permanent fund, and how it looks in our budget, and work with Ledge Finance on some of those options, so we have the from 0 to 4 billion to basically to pick from, and then I'm sure we'll have support here at the table to have some intent language and a reminder next spring or next winter, I guess, to make sure we revisit that. Do we have any final comments or anything from the committee. Senator Bishop.
Thank you. Since we have a few minutes before the bell rings, are you at liberty to explain? Because I tried to get on my ADN account and I get logged out and blocked out, and I get mad because I have to go through all that rigmarole. What you did the other day on the story in the ADN, could you just tell us what the board did as it pertains to the 200 million? And
so that's the end state. What the question is we saw in a newspaper article where the permanent fund board decided to not add money to the in-state investments, because we actually have an investment arm called ADA, Alaska Industrial Development Authority, to do that. I think that was well received, by the way. But we just thought you might want to comment on that while you're here.
It, through the chair, Senator Bishop, yes, the board considered a resolution related to the in-state program at the last board meeting. There were a number of concerns related to the small size of our state and the implication with a small board of primarily business people that you quickly can have a myriad of conflicts that don't allow you to be able to make decisions on your portfolio. There are other concerns related to the use of the investment, meaning that it doesn't have a lot of experience under its belt at this point, and whether or not wanting to be clear that it was an investment that was on par with the expectation of the fund for the asset class. And so before putting additional money into the program, making sure that the program's going to be successful. And so the board approved a resolution, which I don't remember verbatim, but in general places a hold on the program while we wait to see the experience of the two managers that we have at this point over a longer period of time, and then reevaluate in the future.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Okay, we have any further comments before we close, or we'll have just a brief at ease. We're going to come back on the record, and thank you very much for the delay. This concludes the meeting today. I'd like to especially thank the Permanent Fund for the time it took to put this presentation together and come in, because they were here about a month ago giving us a prelude of coming attractions, and it looks like the coming attractions needed to be updated because they were coming a little more than we had hoped, unfortunately, and we'll get back with them when it looks like we need an update. But I do appreciate their willingness to drop what they're normally doing and update their presentation and keep the Finance Committee fully informed as we go through the budget cycle as much as possible. So that concludes today. Monday morning at 9 a.m., we're going to have the University of Alaska's FY24 budget. It'll be the subcommittee of the whole up. We'll also have Senate Bill 98 up, Power Cost Equalization Endowment. And under bills previously heard, we'll have a committee substitute for Senate Bill 107, which is a split bill. It should be up. That bill would have been up today, but we're missing a member, and we feel that issues of this significance, all finance members should be present to put their two cents in and be represented. With that, that concludes today. We are adjourned at 10:18 a.m. We are adjourned.